Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson. It is April, and time for another episode of The Three Horsemen. This month, we are going to revisit the subject of comics. And with me, as always, say hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Hello. All right. I am a blogger and a writer and a reader and a reviewer and all that other stuff all rolled up into a bunch of me. I don't know where I was going with that. It was going somewhere, and then it just went off the rails. Anyway, I write reviews for SF Signal. I am on Twitter way too much as Erudite Ogre, and I have a Tumblr with the same name where I do some book posts, and I write fiction, and I have a blog, occasional blogging. So there you go.
Excellent. And in the other chair, as always, Mr. Fred Kish.
Howdy, everybody. This is Fred Kish. I am Fred Kish on Twitter. Yes, Patrick, I'm on Twitter. I blog at Vernal Alpha. Yes, Patrick, I have a blog. And I'm even occasionally on other podcasts. Yes, Patrick, I'm on other podcasts, even your own.
And I'm Jeff Patterson, and I'm on nothing. You know, they had me on Functional Nerds about a year and a half ago, but I haven't heard from anyone since, you know. Just left me in the dust.
Have they even released the episode?
I think they buried it. It's going to be on the Butcher Babies bootleg cover that they release at some point in the future. I am Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. And I occasionally do stuff for SF Signal, but mostly this podcast. And tonight we are revisiting the subject of comics, and we're going to be looking at it from a couple of different angles. We are coming up on summertime, which means not only the comic book movies coming out, but also the big summer crossovers that Marvel and DC do, and lots of other goodies going on in the comic world, especially, you know, the major crossovers and a lot of other smaller publishing events that have been happening as well. And there's a few indie comics that we've been liking. And you all may remember the first time we talked about comics last year, Fred had just recently been corrupted by this particular art form. And if you follow him on Twitter, you know that he blames us on a regular basis for having dragged him into this.
Twice a week.
and he in turn started dragging family members into it. So I personally, and I'm sure the listeners are as well, am curious as to how it's been working out for you.
Okay, well, I want to talk about a few things on that, but I'll step back one level. And we've heard on this show in the past me talk about my daughter and how she's reading. She is now well ahead of me in reading comics. She is somewhere in the 200s on Uncanny X-Men, pretty far up on Classic Avengers. She's reading Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel, Guardians of the Galaxy, Rocket Raccoon, Independence, like Wayward. She's reading the new Thor, the new Spider-Gwen, the new Silk. So she may have to be on the show with us as a guest at some point, along with John's daughter.
I'm all for it. What is Wayward? What book is that?
Well, we'll get into that later on with Culture Consumed. But yes, I think that is something that will vastly interest people.
Okay. Yeah, I want to hear about that.
So my personal, I wanted to talk about crossovers and jumping in as someone who doesn't have a lot of background. And one thing that I tried to do was, last year when we did the episode about Guardians of the Galaxy, people may recall at that point they were kind of running things like the Trial of Jean Grey, which confused me, a new reader, to no end. So recently I completed getting all the back issues of all new X-Men and everything else that tied in with this particular storyline, to start reading it. And right off the bat, first page of all new X-Men, it says, this is the perfect place for someone new to the series to jump in. And after reading five or six volumes of that, I say, yes, but maybe not so much. Because, I mean, you guys know what the Phoenix is, or Phoenix R, or whatever the appropriate word would be. You know, Jean Grey becomes the Phoenix and destroys a planet, and, you know, all this stuff that I now know by reading that series and reading background, but it confused the heck out of me as to why these aliens were coming in, kidnapping her and taking her and putting her on a trial. Or there'd be a character would show up and they'd be like, oh, it's so-and-so. And I'm like, okay, well, if this is a jumping in point, how come you're not explaining who so-and-so is? So I'm not sure if it's at all possible without buying massive books such as the Marvel Encyclopedia and Marvel Year by Year, A Visual Chronicle. If we had a television camera, you would see me picking up these two muscle-building tomes, which now line my bookshelves, and memorizing them. I mean, I think that this is also what I found with Spider-Gwen, which is, I understand, built out of the Spider-Island series or Spider-Planet or one of the other 8 million Spider-Man comic lines. So I, you know, starting with an issue one, I thought it would be a start of a story, but no, it's building on a previous story. And
yep.
There are references to things and I'm like, what? Same with Silk. I started that thinking that was a brand new thing. And that's a little, that one's been easier to ease into than Spider-Gwen was. I mean, I think the easiest thing for me to ease in that I've picked up were probably the New Guardians, other than the fact that they had this trial running through it, the new Ms. Marvel, and to a lesser extent, the new Captain Marvel. Those seem relatively, I don't know whether they're better written or what, but they were easier to pick up and get into than a lot of these other things that have been massively difficult. I mean, for example, I think I might have all the issues of the Black Vortex at this point.
How could you tell?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen a new thing with a Black Vortex symbol on it in a while, and there seems to be 12 or 14 things in my queue, so I'm hoping I've got a complete set.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I think Omega just came out, but the problem that I've had with Black Vortex is that they came out of order.
Like yes.
Parts 4 through 10 all came out of order, and I'm not sure if I'm caught up yet.
So how do you think I felt not knowing, not knowing, A, how many different lines were going to be involved, and B, that they were coming out of order? I was very confused.
Well, the thing about Black Vortex, let me just interject something real quick, is the fact that I commend them for their intent in the fact that they were taking all new X-Men and Guardians and doing this fun little crossover with them. The problem is I think they kind of shot themselves in the foot, not just with the releases, but the fact that they, you know, it was like every part of the story, they were introducing a new player and half the issue was the new player catching up with everything that's going on around them. And, it kind of struck me as it had the makings of really good space opera, and what I've managed to get out of it so far hasn't really delivered that. But
well, now this worries me because now, of course, every other day or every hour of every day, there's a new release about a new aspect of the new impending Marvel event, the Civil War and whatever, and everything's going to end and everything's going to wind down. So are they going to resolve this thing cleanly before it kicks off again as a new universe? I mean, you know, I've got Uncanny X-Men going back to 1963 to catch up on, so I don't really care. It's going to take me a while to get get involved in the current wars or the current civil war, or whatever the heck it's being called. But it just kind of like, are we really rebooting it, or is this going to be another new 52 where everyone's excited ahead of time, and once it launches, they're going to be like screaming because everything seems to be changed for the worse rather than for the better.
Yeah, well, I'm, you know, the fact that I think Secret Wars is what you're talking about, where they're everything's ramping up towards
Secret Wars, they're going
to be revisiting in the course of that story. They're going to be revisiting various parts and storylines from Marvel history, which is almost exactly what DC is currently doing with Convergence. Now, Convergence was the book that they sort of prepped in advance to cover DC's move out to California.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep insisting that it's not going to have any truly long-lasting effects. But in that, various you know, pre-reboot universes and storylines from DC, including Elseworlds and stuff like that, are all kept under this big giant dome by this giant version of Brainiac, and they're sort of, and they're sort of pitted against one another. And while it's been great fun, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're getting a Hawkman by Tim Truman, and we're getting, you know, Len Wein writing Swamp Thing and stuff like this, and it's been fun revisiting all of them. But at the same time, it's still kind of, you know, they're all sort of saying yes, and we're stuck here in this sort of very, very contrived storyline, you know. So it's been somewhat bittersweet. But the thing that's driving me nuts is the fact that, you know, everything we're seeing with both DC and Marvel ramping up to these, you know, cross-world events is almost so identical. And I'm really hoping somewhere that they've got a crossover between the two companies planned that they just managed to keep this secret in the internet age, because it's been so utterly identical in the way they're building up and the way they're executing it so far.
Hmm. Well, it's, you know, interesting to me because, you know, you could also look at the movies and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and now I'm curious to see how with the Ultron movie coming out, how they're going to tie that into the TV series, if at all. Well, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and The Flash and everything else, or we're going to have, like, multiverses on television and the movies?
No! They did that with Fringe already. We don't need it again.
Yep.
The fact that on S.H.I.E.L.D. they've been talking about you know, the mad scientist from Hydra, who we saw with Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch at the end of Winter Soldier. So I'm certain that there's going to be some pretty significant tie-in, as those two characters have to get introduced into the Avengers movie, and I'm certain it's going to be spectacular. So that'll play into S.H.I.E.L.D. somehow.
And the other aspect of all this is my reading. I mean, I think I'm pretty much, the majority of the reading I do is on a Android-based tablet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably similar enough to those who use an iPad. I started out using my cell phone, believe it or not, with the panel view.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take, it seemed that would take forever to get through a single issue of anything. Now I'm, you know, swooping through a page at a time, and I think I've really only encountered an issue with that maybe with Caliban, which I know you and I, Jeff, both read. There was one issue where they had like a almost like a 4-page panel,
mm-hmm.
and that just would not resolve no matter how hard I tried. But overall, I mean, and I, for example, at the library last week, I took out, speaking of the X-Men, The Age of the Apocalypse multi-volume paper. And opening it up, it appears to me that they've almost taken almost the comic print paper and just bound them up in books. And this looks similar to me to the one paper copy of Transmetropolitan by Warren Ellis that I bought. The digital versions just look so much better.
Mm.
They're brighter.
Yeah.
They're cleaner. They're not smudged. I don't have to worry about pages being ripped out from the library, which occasionally I come across. I'm like, and that's like, you know, as bad as a crossover. You can't figure out what the hell happened in the story in the meantime. I mean, two pages missing is like an entire epoch in some storylines.
Uh-huh.
So reading them on electronic is definitely the method that I'm using. I wish that Marvel and others would make it clearer that we actually own these things rather than rent them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that'll get resolved some century.
At some point.
So that's my commentary.
Wow. So what's the last thing you read? What's the last book you read?
Oh, let me look at my list. Why don't you talk, John, while I look at my list?
talk about it. Okay. How was Lux?
Talk about anything.
Sorry. Okay.
I don't know. I am actually, I mean, I can actually talk from being a relatively recent user of digital comics because I only really started looking at them in a more than passing way after the summer, after my surgery. Someone gave me a bunch of stuff digitized to read, and I started reading that. And then I just recently started getting stuff from Comixology, which was kind of frustrating technically, but I think I agree that the comics look a little better. I mean, one thing I notice is that with paper, each company really seems to have little idiosyncrasies in, and I look at mostly graphic novels. It's mostly what I read, and it's like bound collections instead of individual issues. But even then, there's definitely some variation, and those variations seem to disappear digitally.
Right.
And I've been experimenting with the guided view thing on Comixology too, with their reader. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't have a large enough monitor, I think, to do a full page spread justice. So sometimes it's useful to do the guided view, but at the same time, I find that I have to go back and forth sometimes because I'm so used to reading a comic simultaneously as a page and a progression of panels.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear from like using the guided view that my understanding changes a little bit about what's going on, because when comic book artists and writers plan out their issues, they're looking at the page as well as panel to panel.
Yes.
So a page has a purpose, as well as the individual panels do. And the problem with guided view is that I think you miss the page unless you want to just kick back and forth and back and forth. One thing I have found is I don't have the same problem reading comics that I have reading written work on online, because I don't know if it's a quirk of my vision or just a quirk of how I read. I still have trouble reading novels in electronic format. Although this is going to be interesting, I found that when I use my little tablet, for some reason, I have an easier time reading than on my regular computer screen. I'm not sure if that's the reader that I'm using or...
I've got an EPUB reader on Firefox, mm-hmm. and there was a couple books that I got a few weeks ago, and I started mm-hmm. reading them on the tablet, and I continued reading them on my screen, and I had a much easier time. One of the things for me in reading it was the fact that I got a two-page view, which I think there's some weird intuitive relationship that one forms with a book. And having the two pages laid out on my widescreen side by side like that, it comforts mm-hmm. me somehow, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know why that still doesn't – I'm still not finding it as enjoyable. I've just completed my first novel reading it on the tablet, and I'm well into the second one. And I'm kind of curious. I should compare them at some point and see. But to get back to comics, it is interesting to me that I found it easier to get into comics electronically than I thought it would be. Because I thought there might be more of an attachment to, you know, paper than with written stuff. But it seems to be the opposite is true. And I'm not sure why that is, but I'm kind of enjoying reading stuff off of Comixology, but I agree. It'd be nice to be able to, you know, download it. I mean, I ordered like 7 or 8 books in my first order from them, and of them all, only one has a DRM backup.
Mm.
And it is neither a DC nor a Marvel comic.
Mm-hmm. A DRM backup or a non-DRM backup?
Sorry, non-DRM backup. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I find that most of the indies are more likely to do it
mm-hmm.
than the big two. Yeah.
Yep. That seems to be the case. So, and another thing is that for a long time, I haven't really been following comics regularly. I've been waiting for collections to come out to read them. And the other thing with Comixology is now I'm actually reading new stuff, like brand new comics. Mm. And I feel really old. I feel really old.
In what regard? What do you mean? Because I've got something to say about that, but go ahead.
You are really old.
Well, there's that. But there's, I don't know what it is about some of the new stuff.
Oh, okay.
Just reading brand new comics seems like I'm rediscovering an experience I had kind of forgotten. Because when you primarily read graphic novels and collections, it's hard sometimes not to know what's coming. Like, you know, like you can read the back of the graphic novel and it'll have a blurb, or you may have heard about the work beforehand and decide to get it. So picking up fresh stuff, I'm kind of going back to something I used to do for a long time when I was younger and had stopped. And coming back to it is interesting because I definitely see that I'm reading the books differently. When I was younger, I think I was more open to comic books.
To what, kind of new titles kind of, or experimenting just, or?
I'm trying to think of how to put it. I think part of it is I'm a little more critical now than I was when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've had a lot of experience. I've read, you know, way too many comic books. So it's easy to pick up on sort of, you know, conventions and tropes and even plot lines that have been just done a million times before.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that if there's nothing anchored to that that's really compelling otherwise, I kind of don't feel like going on much.
I can't go on.
Can't go on. So to try to put that in a, using to give you some examples, I've read all the Ms. Marvels, the new Ms. Marvel series. I've read all the old ones. I read the old Ms. Marvel series, Captain Marvel again. And I've now read up on the new Ms. Marvel, and it's good. It's quite good. I like the quirkiness of it. And there's something refreshing about the fact that I feel that the main character is much more of a believable teenager than a lot of other teenagers we've seen in comics. Starting with Peter Parker, who was for a long time never a very believable teen to me. you know, there's just a feeling that, you know, the way that, you know, she interacts with her family, which is all living too. I mean, a lot of older superheroes tend to have holes in their families, which is why they became superheroes. And that's not the case here. And in fact, she has to be much more mindful of her family connections and what she does. And I like the way that G. Willow Wilson braids that into the story. And as I said, I've really been enjoying it. It's like I said, it's not just that it's quirky, but there's a lot of interesting subtext in there for me too. To an extent about the nature of, you know, comic books' general disconnect from real life.
Mm. Yep.
So it's really refreshing to read a story that sort of says, okay, I'm going to point this out to you. I'm not going to hit you over the head with it, but I'm going to point out to you, and I'm actually going to make it part of the story. And that actually made me a little disappointed with the latest issue, which is the latest issue is 14. Because the way that the issue's story gets set up felt really tired and old to me, in a way that a lot of the things she's done, that G. Willow Wilson's done in the series, hasn't felt like that. So I ended up being a little disappointed in the latest issue.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure in general how I feel about the whole Inhumans thing. But the latest issue particularly, I like the second half of the issue a little better than the first half of it. But then at the very end, the reveal at the very end, I thought, oh, I hope something more interesting happens next issue than where this seems to be going. So, but like I said, that's me being just, you know, my critical, cranky self.
Well, the one thing I want to add to that for me, see, I'm taking a much more holistic approach to it. I've been enjoying Ms. Marvel, and I've been enjoying a lot of the other lighthearted books that Marvel has been, lighter-hearted books and slightly more naturalistic books. I've been enjoying, you know, the two issues of Howard the Duck so far. I like what they've done with Squirrel Girl and all this. However, for the last 2.5 years, Matt Faction and Rick Remender have been drilling into our heads that the universe is about to end and there's no possible hope in sight, and all the smart guys in the room are all undergoing massive depression and infighting because everything's going to end horribly. And it's just when they start ramping up into the third act of this whole everything is bad and we're all going to die thematic, you know, sense of life that's running through the whole, you know, the main titles of the Marvel Universe right now. That's when they start giving us these nice books. And that's when, you know, Jason Aaron gives us the female Thor and really starts to, you know, spark some life in the whole Asgardian end of things. And that's when Brian Wood gives us, you know, the follow up to Warren Ellis's Moon Knight with all the various metaphysical conundrums that he's engaging in. And there's, you know, it's nice to see Marvel become this very multifaceted thing, which is something that DC used to do really well in the 70s, where they had, you know, books that shared a universe, but they all took different approaches. And Marvel's done that a number of times, and it's great to see him come back. But over the whole thing, it's like, oh, too bad the world's ending, you know?
Yeah.
and nobody else knows about it. And one of the other things it does is it... all of the Marvel characters since Civil War, maybe since before that, Avengers dissemble, you know, between things like the Illuminati and the fact that everybody's accused all the, you know, the major level players of being elitist. Well, Marvel's sort of gone out of the way to prove that they are, you know, once again, all the smart guys in the room, including world leaders, including, you know, Doom and Black Panther and Namor and stuff like that, are basically not bothering to tell the rest of the world, hey, the universe is about to end in a horrible way, not a good way either, a really, really horrible end. so it's nice seeing Marvel spread its wings. And I know part of it is because, you know, Disney is finally seeing value in having a broad spectrum platform. And the editors have finally, you know, decided to really, you know, widen the lens on what it is that they're doing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's still this very fanboyish, let's ramp up the disaster level as far as we can and blow up the city again and stuff like this. So as much as I enjoy it editorially, I think it all should have been pinned together a little nicer, I think. Either have a lot of the characters have these wonderful little stories with a sense of impending doom, or draw things out in a bit more of a linear fashion somehow, you know. Mm-hmm. Right. That's my take on it. I read too much into it.
Is that why they announced something about a certain character, was it today or yesterday?
Was it today? I heard about it today. Maybe yesterday, but I heard about it today.
You talking about Iceman?
Yeah, I know you were. Yeah. You were.
Yeah, I'm
quite eloquent about it, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, it's just that.
In a positive way overall.
You know, in a positive way overall.
Just creatively eloquent. Or eloquent about the creativity or the timing or whatever.
I think that. Look, Marvel's going to do what it's going to do. It's a media. They're going to go for headlines. They're going to try to stay in the spotlight. They're going to try to stay relevant, et cetera. I get it. I'm all for it. It's the way all big companies work. TV shows pull out all the stops during ratings and stuff like that. It's true for any form of pop culture, you know. But in service of the narrative of the story, it's A, kind of pointless, and B, in my mind, it's a bit of pandering. And every time Marvel does this, they always pick a character that they've never been able to editorially give its own groove to, you know? And and that's clearly been the case with Bobby Drake. Even in the movies, you're kind of, huh? What is he? You know what? And, you know, Grant Morrison did some fun stuff with Iceman, and the younger Iceman who's been drawn to the present in all new X-Men, I'm certainly enjoying the dynamic between him and the present one, given the fact that the present one really learned how to supercharge his powers over the last few years. But it doesn't add anything to the story. I get the fact that it's opening stuff up to a wider audience, but it's not really adding anything to the story. And given the fact that they've got a lot to get through on that story too, there's a lot of threads that got to be tied up. So,
yep.
So, I'm curious, John, you've talked about indie comics in the past before. Is there anything aside from the big two that's really been catching your eye these days, or?
I've been poking around a little bit. Like I said, unfortunately I couldn't access Comixology very consistently for the last week or so. So I was hoping to do more on this, but, a few things that I read is Kieran Gillen's new book, Uber.
Yep.
I've read the first couple issues of that, and, I'm on the fence about it. I like the premise, and I think there's some smart things going on, but it feels a little disjointed to me. I can't put my finger on why it feels disjointed. A little bit has to do with, and this is very particularly in the beginning, the Ubermenschen don't have a lot of personality, with maybe one exception. And I'm trying to, I guess part of it is I'm trying to decide, is it just a big what if series about if Germans had superheroes, or is there going to be more going on, like with the people, like how the superhumans interact with humans and how humans on their side as well as the other side, you know, deal with them. You know what I mean? There's bits of that in the early going, but I feel like Kieran Gillen is so giddy with the concept. You know, it's like, you know, really trying to put this new spin on things that I feel like some things like characterization are missing out a little bit. But I also like that there are a lot of people in it. And what I mean by that is it's not just a bunch of superhero fights or a bunch of superheroes against soldiers fights. They're looking at people on the ground level too. And I like that. But it seems a little disjointed, like it's still getting its footing. But I'm going to stick with it and see where it goes. I finally caught up on Saga. I've read the Saga collections that have been out.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've caught up on the sort of the loose issues. And that is a fascinating series.
Mm.
How someone has not written a dissertation about this yet, I don't know.
There's been a lot. There's been a lot of online talk about it. Dissertations I'm not certain about. So.
I think it's fascinating on a whole bunch of levels. And, it's really, I found myself after reading the last few issues that I could, I went back and read the first, basically the first collection, to see how strings are being pulled together and how, and also sort of kind of checking in on how consistent the characters are. I think it's very remarkable the way that the characters are developing, but also how they live in this really amazing world and it's so blasé to them.
Mm.
I mean, I remember very clearly reading the first collection, and at the end of it going, wow, this is completely absurd and unbelievable,
mm-hmm.
but it's really compelling reading at the same time. And I thought, you know, if this were a movie, if this were a TV show, it wouldn't work.
It wouldn't.
The robot royalty would look stupid.
Yep.
They'd have to CGI, you know, like the stock, and it would just be terrible. But the freedom of the comic medium in terms of what you can put on the page is really a huge strength for it. And I think that's part of what makes it really interesting is that there's all this fantastical stuff all over the place, but it's just their world.
Right.
It's just their world.
Yeah.
It's just the world they have to deal with and live and die in, and that's that, you know?
It's a new weird space opera, is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. So I think that's, you know, certainly one of the best things out there. And certainly that it got nominated for an Eisner again, so, you know.
Yes.
So, you know.
It has had a little bit of influence on the industry, too, because books like God Hates Astronauts and The Life After and, to a lesser extent, The Wicked and the Divine are books that are coming out that are trying to take that same tack, that are trying to not give you a big reveal every time something unusual walks into the room. They only give you the big reveal when something... when a disconnect occurs, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we've been seeing a lot of that. This is going to sound really weird because it's going to sound inaccurate, and I don't even know how to put this correctly. But the new Flash Gordon series, King Flash Gordon, where they're sort of relaunching all the King Features stuff, it's three issues in, and it's also trying to take that naturalistic, matter of fact tone with the characters of the Flash Gordon universe. And it's, I'm not going to say it's directly influenced by Saga, but I'm definitely seeing that if you were to look at the Flash Gordon pulps on one end of a spectrum and Saga on the other, it's definitely needling up, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the big conventions in a lot of comics, superhero, science fiction, fantasy, whatever, has been the idea of cultivating a very explicit sense of wonder, mm-hmm. including having characters in the story itself who respond like, whoa, wow, gee whiz, you know, all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think at this point, that doesn't ring true for the readership in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're so used to like being basically bombarded by images, by fantastical images all the time. I mean, you know, blockbuster movies, TV shows, advertising. I mean, just, you know, we're to it in a sense, we're kind of like, so not blasé, but in a sense, all that stuff is so naturalized now to us.
Right.
That to try to, I think, portray it as kind of gee whiz, wow, very explicitly is just not effective.
Right.
And what's great about that is I think some people, like with Saga, definitely have taken that as an invitation to say, we're going to make up our own damn world, and our characters are going to inhabit that world. And they're going to behave like that's their world, because that's their world.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, and then play on the possibilities that it opens up. I mean, another great thing about Saga, I mean, I think, is that the way that they encounter new things and how those, you know, how those things act in response is really well done because of that, that removal of the having to have a gee whiz moment, essentially.
Hmm.
It means the characters immediately interact like the characters they are, and there's no need to pause or have a huge, you know, whatever, a huge reveal, like you said, unless it's really integral to the story. I mean, we're so used in superhero comics in particular to having lots of like moments of sudden boom like that, mm-hmm. that aren't always connected directly to the story. Like, oh, let's meet our new, you know, our new member. Ah, I am Captain Amazing! It's like in real life that wouldn't happen. People would be like, oh, hey, Captain Amazing, how you doing? Yep. Yeah, good to meet you, you know, so.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because as you're saying all this, I've been thinking about Kurt Busiek's Astro City, mm-hmm. which is on the current run is up to number, I don't know, 18 or 19, I think, I'm not certain, and one of the things that's always impressed me about Astro City was the fact that he's taking all the conventions. He's taking he is accepting and replicating all the baggage of a superhero universe, including the great cosmic wars and including giant entities that drop to Earth and including ghosts and vertigo type characters and you know, super teams and super villains from street level up to omega level threat. And he's done such a good job with telling these stories that involve, you know, the everyday people. And that gee whiz factor that you talk about is gone when your POV character is a girl that like works the tip hotline for the super team, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a global super team of heroes, and there's this entire, you know, phone answering bank that basically takes calls from people to assess and prioritize, you know, where the, you know, logistically where the team has to be and what resources they have to have available. You know, he's really dug under the skin and what he's done in that book is he understands that the reader is still experiencing the sense of wonder while the characters in the city maybe not necessarily are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you turn a corner and there's a giant hanged man floating down the street tormenting some guy who killed somebody 20 years ago. It's like, okay, we cross the street and keep going. You know, it's...
right.
And, you know, it's sort of an opposite dynamic as to what you're talking about in Saga, but it plays on the same notes.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Definitely.
Wow. Yeah, there's been a few, when we talked about, you know, Black Vortex and the various other crossover things that have been happening with all new X-Men, one of the books that's kind of fallen under the radar, and it's kind of a shame because it's probably been my favorite out of that whole bunch, is the Cyclops book.
Ah, yes.
Where the young Cyclops, who's been brought forward in time, basically gets to see his father, Corsair, who in Marvel chronology he didn't meet until he was deep into his 20s. And Corsair is, of course, a space pirate, as your dad tends to be.
Of course.
He's off with the Starjammers, and they're doing all kinds of space piratey things. And this, you know, teenage kid who's been yanked out of time suddenly finds himself going on a space adventure. And it's been fairly traditional space pirate antics. They're really not bringing anything groundbreaking to the table. But at the same time, it's nice to see a book that's that lighthearted, playing in the playground and without really overlapping with like the humor of Guardians of the Galaxy or the awkwardness of Nova and stuff like that. It's really been its own book. And, you know, the fact that Marvel can do this many, you know, space opera-y series in a row and not have them all basically hitting the same notes over and over again has been somewhat refreshing. And I'm really hoping they can pump that up.
Yeah, I actually found that because someone online recommended a podcast called Rachel and Miles X-Plane, the X-Men.
Ah.
And they're up to episode 53, so I've gone through like the first 16, and somewhere, I think the 16th episode, they might have done a survey of all the current lines and spinoff lines.
Mm.
And they talked to, you know, so I had just read the all-new X-Men and the Guardians tie-in, and the Corsair shows up. I'm like, who the hell is this guy? And and then they're like, oh, and the Cyclops line. I'm like, what, there's another line? And I went out and bought all the back issues because it sounded interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to that.
Yeah, it's been pretty fun. Couple of the books I wanted to mention real quick. Mark Waid did a series about, 10, 12 years ago called Empire, with Barry Kitson doing the art, which was basically, I want to say, 6 issues. It might have been 8 that were spread out over a few years that basically told the story of a villain who, a Doctor Doom-esque type villain who basically managed to take over the world, and his team of lieutenants that he had underneath him, who he kept addicted to a drug that granted superpowers called the Eucharist. And he did this wonderful little series about it. And it had a couple missteps and it had a couple unnecessary plot points. But the series itself played out so well in this almost epically Shakespearean fashion. I'm getting an echo here. It's gone. Yeah, it played out in this almost epically Shakespearean fashion. And he did a digital-only follow-up to it called... I forget what it's called. And it was digital only, and a lot of the digital only comics that have been coming out do a lot of play around with frame reveals and frame dynamics and repeated frames and various word balloons and stuff like that. And as fun as they are, I've been enjoying the first issue of Empire Uprising. That's what it's called. Empire Uprising came out as a floppy book, as a single issue, and they sort of had to translate all of that weird dynamic down to an actual static comic book. And I think they did a wonderful job. And I actually think it's a little bit more enjoyable reading that way. And something, John, something that you mentioned about the, mm-hmm. you know, the relationship you have with panels. I find that true with books in general. You know, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about reading an EPUB as opposed to reading something on Kindle is that Kindle's always telling you how far from the end you are. EPUBs, depending on your reader, tend to not do that. And as everybody knows, as you get near the end of a book, your mood changes and your relationship with the book itself changes. And if you don't know when it's going to end, that particular aspect of the relationship is sort of subtracted from your reading experience. And when I'm reading longer comics and collections electronically, I find that that tends to be the case. I was reading Alan Moore's Nemo River of Ghosts a few weeks ago, and I'm reading it, and it got to the end, and the end came so suddenly for me, even though they were wrapping the story up and getting there. I was like, wow, that, you know. And then I realized, yeah, I had just read 70 pages, and I hadn't realized that it had gone by so quickly. So that's one of the things that I really like about reading electronically. The limitation that I find is you get a book, going back to Alan Moore, you get a book like Promethea. You're just never going to be able to enjoy that electronically. He pulls out every narrative and artistic trick in the book to make you turn the book upside down and invert it and hold it up to the light and do all these, you know, trippy things that, you know, he's really testing the limits of what you can do with the comics itself. Straczynski did that a little bit with Rising Stars as well. But when they're working in the confines of something like that, look at Watchmen with its panel layouts. Look at, I'm coming up with nothing but Alan Moore stuff here. Look at Miracle Man, especially when you get into the Olympus storyline, where he would have, you know, certain panels that would curve across the two-page spread while everything else was sort of built brick and mortar around it. There are people that are still managing to do that electronically, and mm-hmm. people that have managed to make it enjoyable. And I've really liked a lot of the stuff that in Fables, the way that Fables has been laid out these past couple of years, since they've accepted the fact that a lot of people are reading it electronically, they've really made it very e-reader friendly. But at the same time, they've really introduced a lot of fun new tricks and stuff like that. When Warren Ellis did Moon Knight last year, he also, when it came to the single page, you know, no double page spreads, just sticking with the single page frame breakdown, that read so beautifully electronically. It was just wonderful. Wherein there have been other books that have been coming out that I really don't think have managed to really pin it down. And the other thing that I like when you talk about getting old, and that's the fact that I love being able to zoom in on art. You know, you talked about the fact that you know, books look different on paper than electronically. Well, a lot of that is because all of this art is being done electronically these days. All this art is being electronically mastered. And, you know, I look at illustrations that I've done electronically, and they look beautiful on the computer screen, but they look like crap on paper, wherein stuff that I pencil onto a piece of paper tends not to look as good electronically. There isn't a true one-to-one translation. And as a result, I think the more that a lot of these books are being, you know, generated with higher and higher tech at greater and greater aesthetic thresholds at the crossing, I think a lot of this stuff is going to look significantly better electronically than on paper. And one book that I did want to mention, I think Fred mentioned it earlier, was the Star Trek ongoing.
Yeah.
That's coming out. The last two storylines of that, which were Behemoth, the one about this giant dilithium eating space thing that they encounter, and the current one, Eurydice, which is the first time that we've seen anything similar to Mos Eisley or something like that, a city, a hollowed out asteroid actually, that's full of aliens. They're obviously trying to play on the Nowhere from Guardians of the Galaxy for a bit, but it's the first time we've actually seen this particular batch of Trek characters in an environment like that, really being out of their comfort zone. You talked about the Darth Vader book,
right?
Which has been a wonderful book.
The best of the batch.
Yeah. And I find it really interesting that, you know, I talked about the similarities between DC and Marvel, that both the Darth Vader book and the Star Trek ongoing have both elected at this point in time to introduce scrappy, duplicitous, young female characters full of competency, agency, and obviously with a few tricks up their sleeve.
Right.
And I'm kind of curious how each is going to handle their take on this a little bit. The one in the Star Trek book clearly is a touch more morally ambiguous than what's the girl in Vader? The girl, the robot expert there. I forget her name.
I don't remember right now, but yeah.
But she's been great with the evil C-3PO and stuff.
Oh yeah,
she's been fantastic. Sort of makes you sad that she wasn't in the original trilogy. Actually,
I mean, when I first got it, I was like, "Yeah, Darth Vader's probably going to be the dullest because you know what can you do with him?"
Right.
And they figured out what to do with him. They give him somebody to bounce off of.
Oh, it's been. And they've made him evil too. They've made him ruthless, which has been probably the thing that impressed me the most about it.
They announced a Lando Calrissian title.
Yep.
So I hope that has a little more freedom, and I'm hoping if Han Solo spins off, he gets a little more freedom because I just think, Luke and Leia are just kind of boring.
What I'm hoping is going to happen, I would love to see. I know they don't want to start playing with extended universe, but the last Star Wars series that Brian Wood did for Dark Horse also took place between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, and which is what they're doing with this whole unit. And I was kind of hoping we'd move. Yeah, it's fun and it's enjoyable, and I don't want to call it a retread because they're doing some interesting stuff, but I'd really like to see some stuff from some other time period. It still tends to fall into not a Star Wars prequel series, but they've got these strict limitations of what they can do.
Right.
And Lord knows they've done a lot of stuff unexpectedly so far that I didn't think to come out of it. I remember when DC was doing the Star Trek book, and it was after Star Trek II, but it was before Search for Spock, and they had all these storylines where, you know, Kirk is talking to Sarek and stuff like this, and then after the next movie came out, they had to kind of go back and reset because, oh, look at all this stuff that we did that it turns out doesn't fit continuity-wise because of the movie. The same thing with Dark Horse and the Aliens books. After Aliens, there was that whole great series about Newt, and then in Aliens 3, Newt died in hibernation, so it was all a dream or something. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's just the problem with comics wanting to have continuity and
right.
canon and,
yep.
you know, just...
Yeah.
When I first started out reading comics, that was a huge deal to me. And now I kind of just wanted to tell stories and not be so concerned.
I feel the exact same way. Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, it would mean we wouldn't have any more of these stupid, you know, continuity resets, you know, cloaked as massive events that will affect the future of the blah, blah, blah for the blah, 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 blah. I mean, they're just... And this is where the place where I feel old. It's like, you know, I've been around since Secret Wars and the first Crisis, okay?
Well, the thing that I've been saying is that look at all the stuff they've been doing with Archie, with the zombies, and they're introducing the Predator, and they did an Archie Kiss crossover, and it still makes more narrative and continuity sense. over the long history than what we're seeing coming out of Marvel lately and DC for the last 10, 15 years.
Right.
There was two other things I wanted to mention real quick. Valiant Press, which Lord knows I have not read in a long time, has been doing all kinds of reintroductions of their characters, and they have two very science fictional books coming out right now, one called Divinity and one called Imperium. And Imperium has had a very neat little international intrigue about superpowers that's been very good. And Divinity has just been, I'm gonna withhold judgment until we get to the end of the series, but it has just been so odd about this black orphan who grew up in communist Russia, and they sent him on a prototype FTL starship, and he came back very, very changed, and he's doing odd things to Australia. It's been a really good book to the point where I didn't even realize it was part of the greater Valiant universe until I think the end of the third issue. But it's been a lot of fun. And I want to talk about tie-ins real quick because they just wrapped up Clive Barker's Nightbreed with issue 12. And that was a really good, I thought that was a really good follow-up to the night. I didn't think they were going to be able to get more mileage out of the Nightbreed story, and they really did. And the other book that I have been enjoying, what was it? What was the other? There was something else. Godzilla Rulers of the Earth has been really good, too. That's been a lot of fun. I've mentioned it before. Doctor Who comics, especially the 11th and the 12th Doctor. Behind, I think, one issue on the 12th Doctor. But the last storyline they did in that was fantastic. The 11th Doctor, this weird little multi-part story about this empathic alien and the Doctor gets co-opted by this sentient corporation and stuff like that. It's been really, really trippy. And they just started doing the 10th Doctor, too, launched right around the same time as the rest of as the other ones. And it's been fun. It's been sort of on par with the 10th Doctor was starring in the book, basically solo before. It's been a lot of fun. And the Legendary line that's been coming out where they've been doing these kind of weird little steampunk reboots of characters like Vampirella and Green Hornet and Doc Savage and stuff like that. They've been doing a lot of solo books lately with primarily Vampirella and Green Hornet that have been a lot of fun. And I would also be remiss if I did not mention that there have been two issues of Lady Mechanica this year.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I just looked at number four and I, it's an okay story, but my God, he does gorgeous full page spreads.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the full page reveal. It's like every time a character shows up in a fancy dress, here's a here's a page of Finch doing intricate lace work on a cyborg or something like that. So, groovy, yeah. Like it's been. Yeah, it's been weird because with the ascent of the movies and the influence and popularity of the movies and the impact that they are having on the comics themselves, as well as the fact that the comics are trying to cash in on that by having these big events that A, they try to make easy to jump onto, and B, they try to pay service to the histories that have come behind them. It's a weird dynamic. And like John said, you get to the point where you just want it. Just give me a damn story. You know,
I've been reading a lot of just damn stories too. Not only Marvel, but like Trees by Warren Ellis.
Oh yeah.
Or The Fuse by Anthony Johnson or Copperhead and Caliban. And I think that half of my purchases have been independents at least. And I'm trying to be as wide ranging as I can manage. If it looks interesting, I'll try at least one, and I usually end up subscribing. And there've been some fantastic reads, like Trees or The Fuse.
The Fuse has been spectacular.
Yeah, Letter 44.
Love it.
I mean, I think hard science fiction is really doing well as comics.
You know, and something weird. When John mentioned Saga and the dynamic it takes, Letter 44 is one of those books that I'm having a hard time getting my head around, because you can at least in a lot of books, including to an extent Saga, have a sense of how things are going to tie together.
Mm-hmm.
And Letter 44, I have no idea. It has been, it has been these, you know, two sets of storylines that, you know, obviously separated by most of the solar system, but at the same time, it becomes a very curious thing as to how far this book is going to go, you know.
Well, assuming that it's a one-off and it's not going to be rebooted or tied in or evented, I mean, it's possible that he may be, they may be able to draw this all together and do a fantastic job at it.
I hope so. I really do. It's been so good. And Fuse has been interesting too. I've been watching the old episodes of DL and Pasco from the BBC from the 1990s, and watching those while reading the Fuse has been very, very interesting. The whole curmudgeonly detective thing being done at in a very interesting sandbox. That we're still learning about. That's been the other fun part about it too, is that we've been still learning about it.
Right.
That's been good. Have you been reading Postal? Has anyone read Postal yet?
I think that's one. Did I buy that one? Maybe I bought that because you spoke about it and I did.
Yeah, three issues out so far. Right, I think the third one just came out.
Yes.
About the town that's basically all the criminals too deadly to put in jail. The feds put them all in this little Mayberry town, and the mayor's son is autistic, and a murder occurs, and the son is the one obsessed enough to want to solve it. It's been really, really fun. I've been liking it. And I think Velvet's back this month too. That's been one of my favorite books, completely non-fantastic storyline whatsoever, straight spy noir stuff, 70s spy noir stuff. And it's been solid. Oh, Chrononauts came out since last time we talked.
Okay.
Have you picked that up? The new time travel Millar book?
I don't think so.
Yeah, two issues of that are out, and that's been he's sort of threw the rule book out on time travel stories here, wherein time travel can be televised, and when the mission goes wrong, everybody sees it. And the other, have you been reading Loki, Agent of Asgard?
That one I have not started yet. It's on the wish list to buy once I catch up a little more with current stuff.
Yeah, I think you're going to need to read Journey into Mystery first.
Here we go.
Yeah, the last Journey into Mystery, which was the Loki book, you're going to need to read that first before Loki, Agent of Asgard. But Loki, Agent of Asgard is really good. Right up there with like the stuff that they were doing in Hawkeye and things like that. It's been, yeah. I'm just looking at my list here to see if there's anything else that's been leaping out at me, because there have been. Oh, Dying in the Dead. That was the other one. Dying in the Dead is also really good. Once again, I'll have to wait to see how it actually plays out so far. It's been a lot of very effective mood building with, curious to see how it's going to take off. So,
culture consumed.
What else have you been reading, Fred?
Well, I wanted to talk about. I mean, what else have I been reading? God, what haven't I been reading? Annihilation, Guardians, Pet Avengers, Rocket Raccoon, all new X-Men, a strip called Pathfinder. All new Hawkeye, which we're still waiting for the not quite so all new Hawkeye to finish.
Yeah.
Captain Marvel, Darth Vader, a Hawkeye and Mockingbird omnibus, Silk, Spider, Gwen, the new Thor, and Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. And the one that I really wanted to talk about was the one I mentioned way, way, way back, Wayward. Wayward is written by the guy that he's also writing things like Pathfinder and Skull Kickers, Jim Zub, with some art by Jim Zub and art by Stephen Cummings and John Rausch. It is a creator-controlled comic, so I'm not sure how widespread it's being found. It's on Comixology, which is how I'm buying it, and I know they came out with the trade or the first several issues, but I haven't seen that on Amazon yet, so I'm not sure if Amazon will pick it up, or you can only get it through Jim Zub's website or what. It's the story of a teenage girl, Rory Lane, who she's the daughter of a Japanese mother and a Irish father who are divorced, and she goes to live with her mother in Japan in Tokyo. And she discovers that she can kind of sense patterns. Like she's looking for the path to her mother's apartment and she sees it laid out in her mind. And then when she's wandering around in Tokyo, she runs into three guys who are kappa or turtle creatures. And she's then helped by another teenage girl who seems to be something of like part cat. And things get on. She runs to, starts running into all these teenagers that are have magical powers. And then her mother's it's revealed that her mother is involved somehow. I mean, it's I'm not really sure if these guys are all going to be superheroes or it's, you know, a fantasy series, magical realism series. But it's beautiful artwork, lovely illustrations of life in Japan, interesting stuff on her ordinary part of her life with interacting with being a child raised out of Japan but now going into a Japanese school where things like her having red hair are frowned upon because it's too wild. You know, wearing school uniforms and trying to fit in and make friends, and some of her friends are superpowered and others are not, and you know what's going on with their mother. And but it, you know, it's kind of like there's a long-running webcomic strip called Mega Tokyo, which I've been reading for years and years and years. So it's, if you like that, you probably would like this. If you like anime and stuff, I think you would love this. So we'll have to introduce this to our friend Mr. Wexler and see what he thinks of it. But it did not win a nomination for the Eisner. I believe I was hoping it would, but it did not. But despite that, it's excellent stuff. Do not, you know, do not hesitate. Do not pass go. Try it. So that's probably the biggest thing of my culture consumed, other than all the millions of other titles that I mentioned.
Once you're in, you're in.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, again, this is like, you know, several of the titles that I read it, my daughter reads it, so we both enjoy it. So it's working, you know, both as me an adult, her as a teenager. And I wonder, John, if, I mean, Ms. Marvel is a title that we're both reading and enjoying because I don't have the familiarity with some of the stories that have happened over and over and over again. And neither does she. Maybe that's why we're enjoying it or seemingly enjoying it more than you are, or less critical or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're also seeing the Marvel Universe through the eyes of a self-admitted fangirl as well.
Right.
So a lot of the Marvel history is being presented through the very enthusiastic lens of this young girl who now gets to be part of it.
True.
Which is a brilliant way to do it. You know, I mean, you know, John, I think you mentioned that you had reread Marvels recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And after you said that, that went through my head while I was reading a Ms. Marvel, and I was going, wow, this is sort of a, I don't want to say it's a modernized version of it because she's really not interacting with a lot of the big events that are going on in the Marvel Universe. But at the same time, we're seeing her perception of everything else that's going on around her, and seeing it. If you read just that book and no other Marvel books, it would be very easy to kind of piece together the world that she's finding herself in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's my culture.
One other thing we should mention on the Marvel take. And I bring this up because when we talked about Warren Ellis a while back, we talked about Global Frequency,
right?
Which has pretty clearly been kind of the template for the recent S.H.I.E.L.D. comic, where every issue Coulson and Simmons basically draft other characters in the Marvel Universe to deal with a critical mission that could go south very quickly. The last issue they brought in Sue Storm, the Invisible Woman, and that was a very good issue. And sometimes they're very funny and sometimes they're very tragic. And it's been kind of interesting seeing these little single issue stories that give you a nice hefty slice of the Marvel Universe with Coulson being a very traditional Coulson. And given the fact that this was a character that really wasn't part of the Marvel Universe before the cinematic universe, they've done a wonderful job of making him pretty central to the lives of a lot of the Marvel characters. And I've really been enjoying that book. They've been trying to do something similar with Agent Carter with this book called Operation Sin, but it's not clicking at all. The characters are well written, and some of the post-war stuff they're doing has been kind of neat with a lot of the early Russian heroes, but the storyline is just it's missing a few cylinders, and it really needs to tighten up. So, John, what have you been reading?
What have I been reading? Not as much as Fred.
I don't sleep. What can I say?
When I was sort of thwarted with getting to my Comixology stuff because of technical issues at home, I went back to some older stuff that I have. I reread the Ferrest series.
Yep.
When you were talking earlier about, you know, panels and, you know, the intentionality of layout, working on more than one level at the same time. That's a book that does that to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I really, really dislike the Bottle Imp a lot. Not just because of the character, just like as a narrative device, which is a lot of what he is in the story for a while. Just that's the only thing that really rankled me with that book. I wanted to see everything else work, and it was very interesting. As always, like Willingham loves to play with, you know, fairy tale characters and folklore, and it really comes out really nicely in the stories. So I wanted to go back and reread that as an antidote to having read a bunch of superhero comics and sort of go somewhere different. But I reread that, and I liked it as much as I did the first time. I read, I might have mentioned last time that I was reading Brian Bendis' first bit of run on Moon Knight. I don't know if I talked about it last time or not, but Moon Knight's actually one of my favorite Marvel characters, and I have not read the Ellis run yet. That's on my list of things to get. But I read the first several issues of the Bendis take on it, and I was really disappointed with that I just thought was terrible. Setting aside the fact that, you know, the way they're dealing with his mental status is really, really annoying. The story itself was just not to my taste, really. What else have I read? I actually read novels and stuff too.
Ooh.
Shocking. I finished Liz Hand's Wilding Hall, which I think I talked about a little bit last time, is starting going through. And I'm writing a review for it right now for SF Signal. And that's quite good. And I was thinking about when you were talking about reading between the screen and the tablet earlier, Jeff. Wilding Hall read extraordinarily well on the tablet. I'm now currently reading The Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi, which is a much more standardly formatted novel, and I'm having a little more trouble reading that than I did Wilding Hall, which has a sort of a non-standard novel structure. It's basically a series of snippets of conversation from various people, supposed to take it from a documentary. And at first that was hard to get into, and it starts slow, but I think I did talk about this. Like, I talked about how creeped out it made me, by the end. It was very well done. I also read a nonfiction book I just finished last night, which is The Cambridge Companion to American Science Fiction, edited by Jerry Carnivan and I think Eric Link. This is a new volume in the Cambridge Companion series, and they're making a case for distinct for talking about distinctly quote unquote American, which they mean United States traditions. And it's an extremely mixed bag. I had a really mixed response to it. A couple of the entries are just superficial, and they managed to be superficial and arrogant at the same time. This is sort of a unique thing that I think academics can do particularly well, which is, you know, talk about this thing they know so much about, but end up not telling you very much and sounding very condescending doing it. But there are a couple of really intriguing intriguing pieces in it. The piece on queer and feminist influences was very interesting. I really got a lot out of, I think it was Mark Bould who wrote the section on Utopia, although I really took issue with the way he talked about Utopia. It was a very stimulating article to read and to sort of think against. And I always appreciate that when someone can write a piece that I don't agree with, but makes me think at the same time. And it may be worth reading for people who are relatively new to science fiction or want to learn more about the intricacies of specifically American science fiction. But one thing that occurred to me reading it a lot was how much it's straining against the fact that American science fiction for a long time has not just been American science fiction. We've, you know, gone back and forth with the UK and with Europe, and, I mean, cordoning off discreetly American science fiction closes a lot of doors in terms of talking about the field. And I felt that strain sometimes with some of the articles. And then what else did I read? I'm almost done. I just mentioned reading Paolo Bucalupi's Water Knife. I'm just about done with it. And I need to think about what I think of it. I don't think it's as good as The Wind Up Girl was. But as always, he finds very interesting conflicts to create, and he has a really good knack for finding characters who help exemplify what he's trying to do, like the messages he's trying to communicate, and at the same time tell a good story. So, I'm still kind of working on that one, but I'm nearly done, and I'm reading, I'm actually reading a lot of Bradbury, I'm rereading my copy of the vintage Bradbury. I think I'm going to read maybe the October Country next too, because I've now read the first two volumes of his biography, and I'm finishing David Seed's book on Bradbury from Illinois Press, the Masters of Science Fiction series, which I'm going to probably put all together and write a big article about, but also I kind of want to write something about this Masters of Science Fiction series, because I am really have been disappointed so far.
Yep.
By this series. From the first ridiculous pairing of, you know, Gary Westfall with William Gibson, to what finishing now David Seed's book on Bradbury, which, having now read a lot about Bradbury's life, I'm going to say to him, why don't you go read Jonathan Eller's books and then come back to Bradbury, because you will find out some things you may not have thought of before, and just, I'm very conflicted, but I've actually been really disappointed with the exception of Karen Burnham's book on Greg Egan, which was great, and I liked the John Bruner book. Not as much as the Burnham book, but I like the Bruner book.
Those were the two best, I agree.
Yep, I think so. And the rest have just been like the Benford book, I felt like I was being indoctrinated into the Holy Church of Benford reading it. And it's just like, can you not worship the person? Can you just talk about, you know? So anyway, I think that's pretty much my culture consumed.
Wow. I... finally.
Have we put you to shame, Jeff?
No. Well, yeah, you always do. When you mentioned reading Fables, I just realized how much I feel the same way as you do, but it also makes me realize how much I miss Jack of Fables, the old companion book that came out with Babe the Blue Ox and the evil librarians and the revisionists, and I mm-hmm. really enjoyed that book quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Fables, I finally, and I had been putting this off, and I didn't realize how long I had been putting it off for. It was over 2 years. Read the rest of The Unwritten by Mike Carey. I had probably stopped reading it, well before the crossover they did with Fables, which wasn't really a crossover. It was more of a reimagining. But I had put it off because I have a problem with the story in general, and I finally said, look, Mike Carey hasn't let me down so far. Let me finish this. So over the course of about 3 days, I reread all of the remaining issues of The Unwritten. I read Tommy Taylor and The Ship That Sank Twice, which was the standalone graphic novel he did, and I read the 12 issues of Unwritten Apocalypse, I believe it was called, which takes place after the Fables crossover where everything is really going to hell. It's good. He does a very good job of telling you a epic fantasy story. I've said this before. I said it about Lucifer, which is still my favorite comic ever. Telling an epic fantasy story through a series of small stories. He's managed to do that really well. My problem is this. The crux of the series is the conceit that the narrative fictional world is as real as ours and possibly underpins ours, similar to a very Zelazny-esque fashion. And the story of this guy who finds out that his father had basically fictionally engineered him to be the bridge between the two by writing a series of books that are obvious Harry Potter homages in an attempt to trigger the bridging between the two just doesn't work for me at all mm-hmm. because of the fact that so much of went into this Harry Potter-esque character is obviously taken from Harry Potter, which isn't and of itself derivative. I'm not going to say it's a ripoff, but it's been done before, albeit not as successfully, albeit not as with much staying power. But that's really never addressed. There's one panel near the end where he makes reference to the fact that Tom Taylor was basically just a ripoff of Tim Hunter, which was the Neil Gaiman character that was introduced mm-hmm. to the Vertigo universe a while ago. Which was a nice little in-joke. But all the characters, the villains, the bad guys, the various other forces that are at play, the people that are trying to redeem themselves, the people that have something to lose, are all so utterly compelling. But the story is pinned on this fairly dumb conceit. And it just kept irritating me. Now, a lot of people who get into that type of stuff, I'm certain it's going to play really well for them, and they're happy to be with it. And I will probably reread it at some point again in the future, because there's a villain named Pullman who's just amazing, who's sort of a devil metaphor that runs through it, who's just amazing. And it just became, you know, the fictional world becomes almost a semi-sentient creature of itself, and it worked. But I also kind of grow tired of the fictional world incurring on our own type story. I think it's been done well a few times, and we can give it a rest now. But I said that about zombie stories, and we're still getting them. So,
oh God,
no one listens to me. I started reading Imaginarium 3, the Canadian anthology, a few stories into that. I've been liking it so far, as I have with the previous ones. I think I mentioned last time that I had reread Bloom by Will McCarthy. After I read that, I started looking...
A title, I will point out, that we caused Mr. David Annadale to purchase in
his... Recent
adventures.
Yes, we did. I found myself wanting something in a similar vein. I was going to reread... what was that Tony Smith book? Not Transliminal, the one before that. Metaplanetary. I was going to read Metaplanetary, but I ended up going with the Nanotech Succession books by Linda Nagata, which, and I say this on this podcast way too often, I forgot how much I like those books, especially the second one, Deception Well. That is such a well-done, extremely high-tech space opera book. And it was one of those things that just sort of came out of left field. As I got into it, I started remembering it more and more. Which is not something I can say, the fact that I remembered it, for Clash of the Star Kings by Avram Davidson, which I know I've read before, but I read it again and I didn't remember a damn thing from it. So once again, I enjoyed it, but I'm saying to myself, look, I know I've read this before and I know I've read it more than once.
Well, the buffer gets full. You have to flush it out.
Yeah.
Then it's all new again.
That's true. So I read that. I also reread The Great God Pan by Mackin after listening to an Alan Moore album. I said, you know what? I need to go back and read this. It's been a while. And I had one other thing on my list. What was it? A Soft Baron Aftershock by F. Paul Wilson, which was a story collection. And I was in the mood for some slightly darker stuff, and it certainly delivered. I've also been finding myself going back and reading specific passages or chapters from various books for a few reasons. I've been finding myself going back and reading the last chapter of books, actually, is what I've been finding myself doing this last month. I went back and read the last two chapters of Accelerando. I went back and read the last chapter of Vortex by Robert Charles Wilson. There was an Alex Hughes book that I went back and I wanted to read something of at the end, the way certain reveals were done and stuff like this. And it was for some reason, I was just trying to remember how certain threads were tied together. I was just thinking about, you know, themes and threads in certain books that I like and things of that nature. And I went back and, just wanted to see how they played out. So I've been doing this kind of individual track needle drop that I've been doing on certain books. One of the books that I did that for was Ghost by Piers Anthony. I don't know why I wanted to reread the last chapter,
but
I found
my
copy. Huh?
Neither do we.
I found it and I reread the last chapter and I remembered one character out of the last chapter and I kind of flipped at the beginning and started reading it and I got about 80 pages into it and I was like, why am I reading this book? But it was me saying, why am I reading this book, that actually made me put it down. It wasn't something that was annoying me as I went. I sort of went into it. If you go into a Piers Anthony book with a lot of preconceived notions, it's a lot easier to swallow. It really is. But that's been about it. I've been reading a lot of shorts as well. I did read Django Wexler's cover story in Asimov's, which I liked very much. That was a neat little narrative vocabulary he employs in the course of the story, The End of the War, it's called, that the POV character is using to describe everything that's going on around her. I really enjoyed it. A lot of fun. And I've still got the rest of that issue to read as well. So So that's basically been everything on my plate, aside from the gobs and gobs of comics that we talked about earlier. I've been trying to keep up with DC's Convergence, and like I said, I'm only doing it because it's kind of fun. It's almost like listening to We Are the World. You know, there's a couple artists. You know, there's a couple artists involved that you like, so you want to at least support them. But oh my God, the end result's not all that great. But yeah, seeing Len Wein and Tim Truman and a few other artists come in and stomp around in their old playground has been a great deal of fun. And then you're reminded just how awful and contrived the story is. So, do we have anything else?
I think that if we still have anybody listening to us.
I'm watching the clock. This will be a shorter one. Excellent. Well, we will be returning in May. I hope everybody is well and has some decent weather, and we will see you all in May.
Good night.
Good night.